Welcome to Fahrradio, a podcast about everything and the bicycle. My name is Hans Dorsch and I'm your host for a special episode in English. Für die deutschsprachigen Hörer, heute ist alles in englischer Sprache. Bleibt trotzdem dran, es lohnt sich. In September 2018, I talked to Horace Dedieu about micromobility. Now, at the end of January 2019, he's organizing the first micromobility conference in California. So I thought it would be a good idea to publish the interview as a whole, because it hasn't lost any of its relevance. People that follow news about all things Apple might have heard of him before. Sometimes he was called the king of Apple analysts by the Fortune magazine. Many people might also know him from his podcast, The Critical Path, where he mobile computing and things and all things Apple. and others might also know him already from his latest podcast, which is called Micromobility. I reached Horace via Skype in Helsinki. When he's not on conferences, he's also living in Padasjoki in Finland, in Boston and San Francisco in the USA, and in Torrevieja at the Costa Blanca in Spain. So here's our talk on micromobility.
Okay, so my name is Horace Dedieu. I'm a professional analyst, and my areas of interest and research are mobile computing, which is you can imagine is the mobile phone business and associated devices like tablets and now personal computers as well. And also, and that's been going on since about 2002 and when I was at Nokia. And the second topic is now transportation, which I'm focused in the area of what I call micromobility. And this is vehicles and systems and services that are targeted towards lightweight vehicles. So my definition is that it's a vehicle that weighs less than 500 kilograms. So this is my definition of micromobility.
So as an analyst, are you then an advisor for businesses that want to get into this market or want to open a market?
Yes. So there are companies that are in the market already, and there are companies that are considering it, and there are companies that are trying to ignore it, and I'm an advisor to all of them.
All right. So yeah, well, I have heard your name before, and mostly actually it was in the more or less around Apple products.
Yes.
So that was
I still do quite a bit of work with what I again is mobile computing. Mm-hmm. And I track the industry there, and I track Apple more than other companies. And I began to look at transportation about 3 years ago, and looking at what I thought at the time was actually potentially the entry of companies that were in computing to enter that market. And obviously, this was an opportunity for Apple and Google and almost all the usual suspects, Samsung and so on, all these companies that began with consumer electronics or computers and became makers of telecommunications equipment, which is what phones are, and mm-hmm. eventually now are considering entering into new markets. One is healthcare with the wearables in the case of Apple. And in the case of, at least publicly in the case of Google, entering into transportation with autonomous driving systems. And so naturally the rumors and the announcements being made that these, which are now, by the way, the largest companies in the world by market capitalization, are considering transportation. I thought, well, let's have a look at what transportation is going to look like in the next few years, especially as we see software entering this space. And that research began, again, actually more like 4 years ago. And it has led me to conclude that the most promising and interesting area is micromobility, that the revolution in transportation will come from the bottom. The smallest, the cheapest, and the most likely to be used vehicles are these what we see now as shared bikes, scooters, e-bikes, and potentially more types of vehicles coming down the coming down the line.
I've been following the fusion of computers and transportation, or in my case, mostly and bicycle for a while. Mm-hmm. And until a couple of years ago, smart technologies only appeared in expensive cars, for example. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, dropped down to cheaper cars and most of the time never made their way to bicycles or other, well, that. Mm-hmm. Can you relate to that? Sometimes even car manufacturers, they played around with two-wheel concepts, but they always stayed on the concept side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So first, let me address the question of technology adoption by the automotive market. I would argue that actually the exact opposite is the case. The automotive industry is extremely slow in adopting technology with respect to what we think about as a consumer technology. I'll give an example. It was still possible to purchase a car with a cassette player in the mid 2000s. It is still possible to buy cars with CD players today. It is still possible to have a car which does not have Bluetooth today. It is possible to have cars which do not allow you to play or mount or attach your phone, even though the phones have been around since the mid-90s. And so the industry, and also the availability of things like touch screens, the availability of innovations that have come from user interfaces into consumers already maybe 15 years ago are not yet adopted, except for the very expensive cars. And because they stay in use for so long, you have technologies in cars that are antique today. And so from that point of view, there are some technologies that are adopted that are, let's say, more forward-looking. But take, for example, a camera system for reversing the car, so you want to see behind you. Mm-hmm. This technology, I mean, if you were to measure the quality of that camera, it is something from probably 2003. In terms of its performance relative to what we have today in terms of every phone in use today is so much more superior than that. So in many ways, what happened is the car industry used to be at the forefront of many technologies. In the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you would have very clever systems in cars, from fuel injection to ABS to material sciences, advanced plastics and the use of computer technology to design crashworthiness in cars. All of that was fairly advanced. But the great leap of computing that occurred since, in terms of consumerized microprocessors, displays, memories, and of course software itself, that has gone at much faster speeds than the industry can absorb. And this is because it works on 5-year development cycles for new vehicles and 15-year life cycles for vehicles in use. So it's very possible for you to have a car that was initially designed 20 years ago to still use it. Many people have even older cars. So there's this problem of having a globally 1.2 billion cars that will take, even if they are new, will take 20 years to replace them. And the software changes on a monthly cycle. If you are looking around and using certain services today, and the hardware that runs consumer software is changing on a yearly cycle. So these are incompatible, inherently incompatible. The life cycle of the car and the life cycle of the smartphone, you can use these as a comparison and ask yourself how many generations of smartphones will you have before the car industry adopts, some of those inventions. So in that sense, I think the car industry is the dog, and the tail is the smartphone. It's the tail now that's wagging the dog, because as I say sometimes, I've said this many years ago, that the car is nothing more than an accessory to your smartphone. People are trying to work out how to make their car use the smartphone. It's used for navigation, it's used for communication, it's used to avoid traffic, it's used to avoid boredom, it's used to entertain in the car, and so on. And people are ignoring everything that the car offers except for its engine and so on. So it's a bit of a farce, actually, what's happening with the auto industry, and Tesla notwithstanding, because Tesla is subject to the same time issues that the whole industry is facing. So even if they are successful in growing a little bit, they have to deal with this huge life cycle problem. You had a second part into your question. Can you remind me?
I think it was this the part that technology in cars went from top to bottom.
Yeah, I think I answered that, but there was a second part. But never mind, if we don't remember, it's fine.
I have two questions. So the first is the car over? And the second is, will scooters save our mobility?
Well, so the way I describe the what we need to be able to solve this question is to understand how to categorize properly. The challenge is that cars as a subject are too broad, and you need to define what we call segmentation, or what does the car solve as a problem, and therefore why is it purchased, and why it exists. So only if we understand those answers can we begin to determine the future. So the one way to think about cars is that they have a utility value, and that value is to transport people across distances, and therefore save time and shrink the world. And when you think about that utility value, the main value is, again, distance, is the ability to to travel over space. And when you ask, well, then there should be a way to categorize these, you know, the value of space. And so I look at the measuring trip distances. So if you think about it, the car is not appropriate for traveling 1,000 kilometers unless you have many days available. And you would rather use an airplane for that. Similarly, your car is not very useful for traveling 100 meters because your feet are adequate for that. So in some ways, we have to decide between 100 meters and 1,000 kilometers what is appropriate. Now, what historically happened is that before the car, we had the same problem. People needed to go 1,000 kilometers and people needed to go 100 meters. And they would walk typically more than 100 meters. They would walk maybe a few kilometers. And then came the train. And of course, there was the horse and wagon. But mostly people walked. There wasn't really horses are very expensive to own. So people, average people, mostly walked. And when the train became available, they would take the train. And when the trams and other forms of trains, which were shorter distance trains, they also used those in the cities. And within that environment, you can imagine that the trips available to be traveled, because you could go that far, were somewhat limited because the train didn't go everywhere and your walking wasn't very fast. And there really wasn't anything else. So in that environment came actually the bicycle. The car didn't come first. The bicycle came first. And once the bicycle was available, suddenly new trips were available. And we could travel to between villages. We could travel across a city that used to take all day. Now you could do it in a matter of an hour or so. And so that first vehicle that was personal, the first personal machine was the bicycle, which was the subject of a tremendous boom in the 1880s. And it was a revolution for transport and so society in general. Many people changed their habits because of the bicycle, and women were able to use it, and they were liberated as a result of that. And only after the bicycle, and perhaps because of the bicycle, we had the automobile, because the first cars were really motorized bicycles. The technology that was miniaturizing components that people were able to use, you know, chains and wheels and tires and spokes and all those lightweight materials allowed the car to be born. And of course, it was invented in Germany. And this is the famous Benz patent Motorwagen, and that was 1886. And later, you know, versions of that vehicle were essentially, again, based on bicycle technology. And also the airplane, by the way, was, of course, invented by bicycle mechanics. Now, what's interesting about that story is that once the car became available, it superseded almost all the other modes. So we did actually use the car, and we are now using the car for traveling 200 meters to perhaps, hundreds, if not 1,000 kilometers. And somehow it's considered adequate for all of those distances. But this is a little bit of an inefficient way of travel because, of course, the weight of the car over time has gotten bigger, and the amount of payload it carries is very, very small relative to its weight. And so we have to use 1,500 kilogram car to travel, you know, to transport a 75 kilogram person. That seems inefficient, especially for short distances, but we really haven't had a good alternative. Although the bicycle remained, we built infrastructures for cars and we built our cities to be bigger. And so we live in an automotive environment. What micromobility, and this is the interesting thing, of course, is that we've had bicycles for a long time, but what micromobility is a motorized vehicle, actually. So I define it not just under 500 kilograms, but having a motor and being used for utility transport. And if you think about those three requirements, under 500 kilograms, having a motor and being used for utility, means that it suddenly can cover many small distances. So from a few hundred meters to possibly, 10, 15 kilometers. And that small vehicle shape and size is available now at a very low price, but also available in a shared environment. and very accessible as a result. So you have, because of smartphones and GPS and cheap batteries and cheap motors, we're able to deploy millions and millions of these vehicles in an environment where they're just picked up and used. So what that enables then is that short distances that were used with cars are now more available to a new mode of transport. And so what's interesting is that car companies, and I think I remember your question, why is it that car makers have looked at these vehicles?
Yeah.
They looked at these vehicles and they say, well, this is interesting. Our engineers can certainly make a scooter or they can make an electric bicycle. But the problem is that they have to sell them. Their business model is to sell vehicles and to manufacture large numbers of these vehicles. And when you put that very inexpensive small vehicle into a dealership, how is that dealer going to sell it? Are they going to sell it, for the price of 100, anything from 100 to 2,000 euros? How much margin can they make? How much service revenue can they obtain? How much parts revenue can you obtain? When you start to do the economics on these vehicles, it doesn't make sense to have a factory to make them as you make cars. It doesn't make sense to have a dealer network or supply chain or service network that supports that vehicle. And so when you take that proposal to your board and say, I have an idea, let's make these things, the board will say, no, this makes no sense. We cannot make money doing this. It's not a bad idea, but someone else should do it. And so that's the result. And that will be the answer from every single automaker in the world. Not one automaker will do this. And I guarantee that. This is the nature of business when you have a business model. And they will try. They will certainly do it as an experiment, and they'll amuse themselves doing it. But they're not going to take it to market, and certainly not improve it and make it. And by the way, the problem is that most of these are shared vehicles, and they're not even sold. They're owned by an operator, and that means that you have to put it on your balance sheet. It has to be an asset that you own and depreciate . And all of these things are contrary to the business logic of car making. So my assumption then is that most of these companies that will deploy these fleets of vehicles will be new companies that weren't making cars before. And so that's in a way to describe a disruption, because disruption is a term of art defined by Clayton Christensen, where he said if a new technology enables a new business model that is sufficiently asymmetric to the incumbent will not attempt to do anything with it. But this new emerging model will evolve rapidly and eventually overcome the performance limitations and take more and more share from the incumbent. And the incumbent will abandon this and choose to go upmarket. In other words, they'll go to a more comfortable location where they can still make continuous profits. And when you look at the segmentation that I put forward around trip distances, from very short distances to very long distances, an automaker will gravitate towards more and more long distance because bigger vehicles and heavier vehicles and more long-range vehicles, because that is where the profits are. And they will abandon the short distances because they're not profitable. So this is the classic disruption where from below the scooter becomes a vehicle that expands its range, expands its capabilities, it expands its safety, performance, etc., and eventually takes on more and more kilometers. It begins with 1 kilometer, then it goes to 2, then to 10, then to 15, then to 20. The interesting thing about the distribution of trips, however, is that the vast majority of trips are very short. And in fact, the distribution of trips is such that, and I've done this calculation for the United States, but if you were to take all the trips less than 12 miles, and again, I apologize, this is in miles because of the U.S., but if you take all the trips below 12 miles, they equal in quantity and value in terms of dollars spent to all the miles above that. So this is called the point of parity. At what distance does the value of transportation balance each other on the spectrum of distance, and that happens to be, depending on whether you're measuring dollars or time or distance traveled or vehicle miles traveled, as it's called, VMT, that point of parity is between 12 and 15 miles. I think in Europe it's going to be closer to lower number, so closer to zero. And so it could be, let's say, for the sake of argument, it could be 15 kilometers. And so what that means then, from an economic point of view, is that there's as much value in the first 15 kilometers as there is in every trip taken above that distance. But the car makers will, and your question, will the car die? No, the car will still be used for long distance travels. But those kilometers of the long distance are going to be increasingly uninteresting and not very profitable, and certainly contracting as opposed to growing. And the long-term pattern, of course, is urbanization. We have 75% of Europeans living in cities, and that's going to grow. Globally, it's going to reach something like 60 to 70% by 2050. These are therefore shorter distances, and urbanization drives the trend towards shorter distance, and demand will grow for these types of trips. And as a result, the assumption is that a disruption will occur, and it'll come from the bottom, and we'll see how long it takes. This is the whole debate. My analysis is mostly centered now on how long it takes, not whether it will happen, but whether it's going to be 5 years, 15 years, and so on.
So how long will it take?
Well, it's an open question, and that's why I said it's a matter of research. What we have data on so far, and I'll share this because it's brand new data, there are several, the entire market for micromobility is fairly new. We've had bike sharing in China only since 2016, and these are dock systems. These are the dockless systems.
Yeah.
Of course, dock systems have been along much earlier, but the difference between dock systems and dockless is that there's a lot more accessibility. It's the same difference between having a personal transport anywhere to anywhere system versus a public transport, which is station to station system. And although there are many stations possible, it's still much more restrictive than what we see with dockless. So dockless has only been around for about 2-3 years.
Actually, there has been one dockless system, even in my city, in Cologne, that has been around for, I think, 20 years or so. It was by Deutsche Bahn, and you could leave your bike anywhere as long as it was a crossing. So,
but how was the bicycle locked and unlocked? Or was what was the system? Because the difference with the Chinese system is that you use your phone to unlock the bike because it has GPS and it has communication and so on.
At first, are you interested in that? Because that was really that was in the stone age of telecommunication. You called and the bike had a phone number, and you called this number, and you spoke the names of the crossings where you left your bike.
Very, very clever. I think that makes sense. And of course, you could argue that that's a prototype system. And indeed, it wasn't the Chinese who invented this. And I would give full credit to that. Very good.
They have changed to smartphones now and proper localization.
Of course, yeah. And bike sharing again existed in Amsterdam, the very first system, which was, I think, even in the 70s. But yes, these ideas have been around. It became easier and more accessible once we got this more modern technologies. Mm. And the scooter system, which is actually all the rage now, only is 1 year old. And it began in September of 2017. And the data I wanted to share is that two companies are mainly having the largest market share today in the U.S., mm-hmm. and they are Lime and Bird. Bird was the first to deploy. Again, they were not the first ever. I think it was a Singapore system that was the very first. But it was this is in the U.S., and it became quite a big hit. Yeah. And they both registered 10 million rides in the first year. So in about 12 months, these systems were able to get to that number. Now, when you look at the other types of sharing systems like Lyft and Uber, they didn't get to do 10 million rides for 3 years. So these are, although these are different rides and different prices and so on and so on, the speed, though, is phenomenal. And of course, it's fed by venture capital, and therefore many, many of these vehicles are made available. And that enables, of course, the large number of users. But nonetheless, the Chinese system, by the way, as of February of this year, was cited as having 400 million registered users, 70 million daily active users, and a fleet of about 23 million bikes. So in 3 years, the Chinese system gained these numbers. And these are numbers that are on the scale of Facebook or a social media platform, like an Instagram or something like that. It was growing as fast or even faster than those systems. And when you look at the rate of growth of the scooter sharing network, it's on the same scale as, again, an Android or iPhone, actually probably even faster. We're not measuring the exact same quantity because one is in users and devices sold, the other is in terms of rides. But I've put together the data to show how these curves look. And there's a sort of a pattern to these curves, and you can see that the speed of adoption of these vehicles. Now, again, after 1 or 3 years, we're looking at very, very short time frames. The iPhone, as revolutionary as it is 10 years old. And, you know, in the first year, it was able to sell maybe 10 million units. And so here we are at 10 million rides in 1 year. For one of these bike companies. So again, it's about, when you ask about timing, we have to ask, okay, how fast is it going, and also how big can it get? In the U.S., there are about 2 trillion trips taken every year. 2 trillion is the number. And so, if you assume that, let's say, the addressable is about half of that, then you have to ask how quickly will these systems generate 1 trillion trips a year. So we're at 10 million, and there are many zeros left to go. So, you fortunately, they grow exponentially. And so we cannot add 10 million every year. That will take forever. But it's going with maybe the addition of 1 zero every year. So, in other words, they're increasing by tenfold every year. So then you start to make maybe some estimates. So if you're able to increase by tenfold every year, then I haven't even done the math quite yet, because it doesn't quite grow that fast. But still, we can make some estimation that this is maybe on the 10-year cycle, not a 20-year cycle. But I want to go back and reemphasize something, because if you move 10 million people in 1 year, and in this case, there are two companies, so it would be 20 million people or 20 million trips in 1 year. If you then start was that
for every company, the 10 million, yes, rides?
Yeah, so 10 million is both for individually so Uber announced that they had 10 million in September, and Lime announced that they had 10 million in a little bit earlier, but they had some bikes as well, mm-hmm. Before then, so they include the bikes as well. But it's about 10 million each in each one, so together there are the 20 million in 1 year. So if you think about 20 million generated, and maybe they're going to double next year, or maybe even increase by 10 next year, we can be looking at hundreds of millions very quickly. So then one should ask, and this is America, which is where the car is king. And it's Los Angeles, where the car is even more king. The king is emperor. The car dominates society, and the infrastructure is not even available for these vehicles. The people who use them are taking their lives in their hands, because they are now using helmets. They are riding on streets with cars. They are also on the sidewalk, and the cities are in a panic in many cases, but it's happening. It's happening very quickly. And again, in China, we had a different phenomenon. 400 million people is not a small number. 70 million a day, every day is a huge number. So the capitalization of these companies reflects this. These companies, all the ones I mentioned, Lime, Bird, and in China, Ofo and Mobike, were valued in the billions of dollars each. And so this was created in no time. Now, some of them may be irrational, and we may have them disappear even, but I can guarantee they'll be replaced by something even bigger, because this phenomenon is not just a fad. People are not doing this only for fun. They're doing it because they are getting utility out of it. And that's what I meant. It's, if it was for fun, well, there are many fun vehicles you can use. You can roller skate. You can rollerblade. You know, you can use a mountain bike on a mountain, which is not a utility. Or you can use an electric bike on a mountain. Or you can use a snowmobile in the woods. These are micro vehicles in the same sense, right? But they're not used for utility, and they've been around forever, so their growth is very, very low. But here we have a vehicle that's used for utility purposes to really get around, and it's across age groups, it's across gender, it's across also every city. Wherever they're put in use, they're very popular, and the only constraint is whether cities permit them or not. And so I think the evidence is overwhelming that whether it's a cycle or electric bicycle or a docked or dockless or in this case throttle based, which is this scooter model.
Yeah.
This is resonating with users, and it's growing faster than anything anyone has ever seen before. So there's still plenty of room to go. I'm thinking 10 years is before we reach saturation, and it will take a huge chunk. And the point is that if it steals 5 kilometers out of the car, the first 5 kilometers, let's say, that would destroy the industry. I don't want to exaggerate, but for the car industry to lose the first 5 kilometers. The car utilization, the car sales will begin to be significantly felt. Now, again, it's like saying, if you have a phone, do you use your computer? Of course, you still use your computer, but you start to use your phone for tasks that the computer is maybe not the best, because it's over-serving. So if you're going to text someone or even respond to an email quickly, you're going to use your phone. But you can see the impact of the phone on the computer industry. The computer industry collapsed already beginning in 2010. And since 2010, the PC business has gone down every single quarter.
And you probably know the numbers comparing the Mac and the iPhone, for example. I don't have them in my head, but I know they're amazing. So the Mac is a niche business.
But that's right. So the personal computer, so this is the general, the Mac has been doing well because it's been growing against the PC. Mm. But the overall PC plus Mac business, if you take those two together, that has been contracting for 6 years, or more than that, maybe 8 years now. Mm. And the result is that Microsoft has had to change its business model to be a service company, not selling software anymore. That is, they moved to the cloud and began to sell software as a service. And this is something that has kept them alive. But if they had stayed selling Windows and Office, Windows mostly is sold when the computer is purchased. so they get paid at that moment in time, that business is going away. So this is the question for car makers. Again, they might need to switch their business the way the Microsoft did in selling cars as a service. But if they don't, it's going to be in 10 years, it's going to be a crisis for them, for the most of the car makers. Again, all throughout this period, because disruption teaches us exactly what happens. Disruption is been this wonderful theory that predicts exactly how this happens, but it doesn't mean that those who are affected by it and know the theory can do anything about it. That's why it's called a dilemma. It's the innovator's dilemma. As this is happening to you, as the frog is being boiled, and as the old story goes, the frog doesn't jump out of the pot. The temperature is rising, but they don't feel the pain immediately. And for a long time, actually, it feels better. And so this process, it feels better because you're going to abandon less profitable markets. So you might abandon, for example, if you're a car maker, let me give you an example for Ford. So Ford in the United States is going to sell only pickup trucks and SUVs. And one sports car, the Mustang. Mm. They're abandoning the sedan market. And the sedan market and the smaller cars, the hatchback and so on, are unattractive to Ford. These are not profitable businesses because these products have low margins. And guess where they're used? They're used in cities more. And what they're selling are rural vehicles. They're vehicles that are driven mostly outside cities. If you look at an American pickup truck, it's very, very big. So you can't really put it in a city. You can't park it. It doesn't fit in the garage. It's an ex-urban vehicle. But you can look at Mercedes. You can look at any of the car makers and ask them, well, what are you making these days? What is your most profitable segment? They'll say, well, SUV. Even Volvo, even a sports car company like Ferrari and Lamborghini are making SUVs. Are these city cars? Are these short distance vehicles? Not at all. Quite the opposite. So they're fleeing upmarket. It's the place to go, right? Whether they're electric or not, you know, they'll make them electric because it's actually more profitable because the buyers are interested in ecology now, and so they're paying extra, as they showed with Tesla, is that they're willing to pay extra for that electric credentials, but that's sustaining. That means that we'll take electric and run with it. But if you tell someone who's making a Ford pickup truck or someone who's making the greatest SUV, whether it's Volvo and as they just launched the vehicle or Jaguar or Mercedes, how about a bicycle? How about a scooter? Again, you can see how the answer goes there. But what does the scooter guy do next after he deploys, you know, a 10,000 of the first generation? In a few months, they're going to evolve the vehicle to something more robust. They're going to have a bigger battery. They're going to have bigger motor. I know some of the plans. They're going to be looking at ABS. They're going to be looking at traction control. They're going to be looking at stability control. Because why? Because people are getting hurt. So they're going to solve the problem with technologies. So they're going to add into the vehicle on 3-month cycles improvements. 3 months, not 3 years. And so when you're seeing that type of change, and also because these vehicles last in the field, remember I began the conversation about the fact that you have cars lasting for 15 years in use. These if you look at the economics of Bird, these vehicles last 3 months in use. 3 months. So in 3 months you have the chance. It seems like a bad thing, but it's actually paid for itself. It's made some profit, and then you replace it with something better. And so the evolutionary cycle, it's like a virus. A virus or a flea or a fly, it lives so short that it's able to evolve more quickly than an elephant, right? And so the mosquitoes and all these other types of animals are adaptive, whereas the long-lived are having to deal with with these parasites potentially through very different methods than sort of evolving. They'll have to. That's why we developed immune systems. But that's one of the characteristics of disruption, is that the entrant is far more agile than the incumbent, and is able to quote unquote eat its opponent. And you know, Marc Andreessen uses the phrase that software eats the world. He's essentially referring to the idea that software evolves much more rapidly than the other businesses do, and therefore it's able to take over.
I talked to one of the leading persons of the European Cycling Federation. Mm-hmm. It's called ECF. It's a lobby group for cycling in Europe. They work with and for the EU. They are based in Brussels as well. I talked to him in July, I think. Mm-hmm. And he told me that they have great worries being left out of the future by the, as he called it, industrialized mobility. Uh-huh. So he said they don't sit at the in the right rooms and not in the rooms together with the people that decide over the future of transportation. Well, he was afraid of autonomous vehicles, uh-huh. that they could, well, take over the streets and by, say, cities making room for autonomous cars, buses, whatever, they would put cyclists and pedestrians on the sidewalk again. Hearing you talking about this power of the small vehicles, is this fear still real?
No, it's not. And I don't disagree with his points that the decision makers are ignoring cycling. Disruption doesn't work on that basis. Disruption is inherently unforeseeable. It means that everyone who's looking cannot see it. Mm-hmm. And that includes car makers, which I explained how they cannot see it. It includes policymakers, city planners. It includes the consumer and the very user of the service, and includes those who are watching the vehicles like a hawk. These are the actual cycle companies. They don't see it either. And they cannot see it because they're selling products that do a different thing. And as an advocate for that industry, they're also talking to everyone else. They're talking to the city, they're talking to the vehicle companies, and they're hearing the same invisibility. They're hearing the same, I don't get it, or I'd rather let us look here, not there. Let us look at autonomy. Let us look at city streets. Let us look at what we can see. You cannot have a conversation about something that you cannot see. And so in that sense, his worries are in a sense valid given what we know, but they're not valid given what we don't know. And the what will happen, again, having this theory of disruption gives you visibility into the invisible to some degree, because you have to have faith in the theory. You don't have actual evidence. You just have faith. But the faith is telling you that there will be billions of trips taken, that these streets will therefore be filled with these vehicles. And whether the politician or the policymaker or the scientists have made plans otherwise doesn't matter, because people, ultimately, the masses will change opinion. Again, we've lived through this over and over again. We saw it with a personal computer. IBM and Digital Equipment could have been studying the computing market for decades. It didn't matter. They did not see a personal computer. Or you could have seen it with the phone business, and telecommunication companies were were looking at both cellular and fixed line and making plans, but came the smartphone and everything changed. And of course, behavior of users on phones dictated that we don't talk on them anymore, but we use them to look at them. And that meant that none of those conversations about voice communications were interesting anymore. And it is the same thing going to happen with autonomy, because autonomy is trying to make an existing system better. The existing system being cars on streets and making those cars better. But the car is not the subject matter. The car is a bundle of trips. It is a bundle that we prepay of trips between a few hundred meters to a few hundred kilometers. And if you understand that your entire objective of car ownership, car structuring, car regulation is based on the bundle of trips that will be unbundled, that the trips will not happen all in the same metal box, then none of it is relevant. It's a completely irrelevant conversation to talk about autonomy or even electric drive in cars. This is like talking about whether a mainframe computer should be made of aluminum or steel. It doesn't matter. It's not a thing that will matter to anybody in 10 years.
So, as I have spoken to many advocates before, they have been fighting, they have been working hard for 30, 40 years to give cycling, or they also call it active mobility, to give cycling or walking the room in the cities. Mm-hmm. Will their work just be obsolete, which would be okay?
No, it's not. They will be. And I follow these advocates myself, and I read as much as I can, and I speak to transportation researcher who write books about this. Mm-hmm. And it has been a multi-decade effort. I spoke at a conference, an urbanization conference, and they're really working hard to make this happen. I think they will be drowning in success. It's going to be far more successful than they thought, but not because the streets and they convinced the politicians to change the rules. It's because the streets will be flooded with vehicles that will be brought there by new companies. And I mean, it's interesting also, I would visit with bicycle companies at Friedrichshafen, where there's the Eurobike show. For 2 years I've been there. And
there this year as well?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
But there I too observed, and I felt that industry was going to disappear. And in the sense that vast majority of those vehicles on show are recreational, and it's a longer story as to why it is such a strange business, the bicycle business. But what we're seeing now is that the bicycles that are the most popular in the world are made by service companies. They're not made by bicycle companies. So those service companies in China, for example, or scooter company in the U.S. will buy the factories, buy all the capacity of components, so that it won't even be possible to make a bicycle if you're not one of them. Because right now there's actually a fight going on. I don't know if you know this story, but the scooter business is in such high demand for scooters that there are supposedly deals being done on the ships coming over from China, and you know the captain is selling containers on the side, because they have so much demand that they're scrambling to get, because whoever gets more of those scooters on the street faster is going to get the bigger raise in valuation. And that raise in valuation means more capital flows in. The more capital flows in, more, you can see how that can spin out of control. And as a result, if they realize, hang on a second, we can't control the supply chain because the captain is selling containers to somebody else. Well, I'm going to go back and buy the factory because I have billions of dollars. Why wouldn't I? Or I'm going to buy the ship. You see, Apple did this. When they went through the process of building their phone business, they had difficulty with the supply chain. So what they did was they ensured that there would be a supply of components. And so they pre-purchased the components before they were made. Yeah. And therefore guaranteed that there would be a supply, or they even bought the tools necessary to manufacture the components, and nobody else could manufacture phones or Macs the way Apple did, which was this aluminum technology they used for years. It was exclusive because no one had the machines to make such a thing. And why? Because the money is so tremendous in this space, and already you're willing to exercise enormous leverage with your balance sheet. So if you have, as Apple does, hundreds of billions of dollars, you can buy anything. And we're not there yet with scooters, but I mean, once that happens, you see that the something, this begins to evolve very differently. The design of the bikes, the design of the scooters will be done in-house. The components, there won't be batteries available. I think this industry could consume so many batteries, for example, that it'll be hard even for some car makers to get a hold of the supply.
The problem was different before, wasn't it? Like the bike industry was minute, or the e-bikes were minute compared to the batteries, the car.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm not going to suggest, because I think battery capacity is going to grow very rapidly as well, but there'll be some critical components that might be becoming more and more a battleground. This is why when you start to look at some of the numbers, which is what you do as an analyst, you start to say, well, what happens if you have 30 million shared bikes? 30 million, let me put a moment and stop there, because the number of cars in the world being built every year is 80 million. Maybe with the other kinds of vehicles like trucks, it's 100 million. If you look at the bicycle industry also, that's also on the same scale. It's about 80 to 100 million. But if in 1 year you shift demand and say, okay, well, I have placed an order for 30 million in 1 year, that means either the industry has to increase by 30%, or 40%, it has to increase in 1 year. Or, because it cannot build factories so quickly, you're going to allocate 30% of the existing industry to serving a company that didn't exist last year. And so where does that capacity, where does it come from? You have to imagine that there'll be a big disruption in the supply chain, that that the companies making regular bicycles will suddenly find themselves without a source of components or other things. It varies quite a bit, obviously. But I also noticed that the bicycle industry is very, very strange and very old-fashioned. It's not just in time. It's not efficient in terms of its supply chains. It takes 6 to 7 months to have an order filled. It's sold through very limited channels, including retailers, who are very few of them. And as a result, it's easy to push them aside.
Yeah, if you go to a bike shop today and want to buy, well, a certain bike, Yeah, it's most likely that you can't buy it,
right?
Because they only get the next shipment in spring.
In spring, exactly, which is the season. And I also can tell you that the markup in the retail is significant. Could be 25, 30, even 40%. Why? Because the retailer has to sit on that inventory all year, right? So they order in the spring and hope to sell it throughout the year. But that means that they have huge costs built into the system. So you don't have direct sales, you don't have economies of scale, and no single manufacturer can guarantee larger quantity. All of this is archaic. It's not what what consumer electronics. And again, if you come from the phone business or even consumer electronics business and you go into this space, you're thinking you've gone back in a century. And of course, the people who are trained in this are coming from also from software. They're going to come into this and say, okay, we're not going to do it at all the way these people are doing it. We're going to completely do it our way. And as a result, we might see some disturbance, to say the least. And again, this is why if you are in that space today, I was in Friedrichshafen and I was surprised that among the participants there, nobody had even heard of Bird. This was in June. I think it was in July or June. I don't remember, but
yeah, this year it was early. It was July. Yes.
Yeah. So there were like, scooters are a kind of a fun alternative. I mean, I went to a scooter maker who to test the product, and I asked them. Now, this is a scooter company in either Germany or I don't know, in Europe certainly, but. I said, well, you guys know, you know, what are you doing with Bird or what are you going to do about Bird?
And did they do electric scooters?
Yeah, electric scooter. I went to test drive and yeah. The person there had never heard of Bird.
That's true. Yeah, there's one maker. They are called Flynn. Maybe you saw.
Yeah, I know them. There is ZF. Yes.
Yeah. And but they told me, and they the product manager
Magura ZF is a consortium.
Yes,
The Breakforce One. Yeah, I know. I met them. Yes.
Yeah, and the product manager told me that they envision this scooter as a personal device to keep and to carry with you.
Yeah, and it's not going to work that way because it's like the camera in your phone. It's like they're making point and shoot and DSLR cameras, and they're not thinking about smartphones as having cameras, because the phrase that's used in the smartphone businesses or generally in the camera business is the best camera is the one you have with you.
Yeah.
Well, the best scooter is the one you have with you, and so the you're not going to take it with you every day. So if you do take the train. And you take the car somewhere and you want to make another trip, again, complementary, multimodal, all of that is going to be enabled because you have a scooter available outside from a service company. It's not going to be a great scooter. In fact, none of those scooters are great and none of the bikes that are in use are great. But the ones that are in use are used so much more than the ones you have at home. So these bikes are used 5 times a day. Think about riding your personal bike and how many times, many people do commute with them, but vast majority of the billion bikes that are in the world today, maybe 2 billion bikes that are in the world today, are never used, are used once, twice a year. And so, you know, the economics are pretty clear what's going on here. So I don't have anything, I think it's great that people are advocating for cycling, but they're speaking to the decision makers about infrastructure when what will likely happen is they will be drowning in users that are going to use these vehicles without infrastructure, and then the infrastructure follows. It's the causality, therefore. So maybe if I can summarize it this way, one of the assumptions that people have, and this is true about development in general, is that if you build infrastructure, then growth follows, because you see a correlation between the two. If you have infrastructure, then you have growth. The problem is with a lot of historic, like even the automobile. You had the invention of the automobile before you had the invention of the roads that enabled automobiles, especially the Autobahn, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't build the Autobahn before you had a well understood product called the automobile. So you you didn't build rail networks before you had invented and already prototyped quite a bit the locomotive. So the thing about infrastructure now is that we're building it on the assumption that of what we know. And these vehicles that are going to emerge are likely to drive their own infrastructure, and it's going to be potentially even paid for by these companies. I wonder how much, what would stop them? What could stop them when so much capital is involved? When I spoke about the fact that 1 trillion trips are up for grabs in the United States, globally, probably we're looking at 3 trillion trips. I think, you know, at 50 cents a kilometer, we're looking at tens of trillions of dollars. And that's just incredible. There's no limit to what can happen when that much money is at stake.
So that's one thing they are worried about as well, is how to make this mobility available to people that don't have a lot of money or don't have money at all.
Well, that's another beautiful thing, is that when the car was born, it was very expensive from 1880 until 1915, when Ford Model T came out, and suddenly the price collapsed because it was made very cheap. And so it was made accessible. And so these transportation options, I mean, what do you have today? You're asking someone to pay 35,000 euro for a car, or you can pay 35 cents a kilometer or less for riding a scooter or a bike. I know they're paying, the cost of entry into a bike sharing system is $1 in the US, $1 to begin, and then something like 25 cents a minute afterwards.
I mean, you can buy a car, a used car, that will bring you from A to B for about, well, say, 800 euros or so.
Sure.
I haven't bought a car for years, but apparently people drive those cars, but they won't be let into cities anymore, I think, in the future.
It's possible, but I know cars well, but the thing is that also, as far as the auto industry is concerned, they hope to gain 35,000 from a new car. So that this is where it hurts, because if you switch to used cars, it doesn't help benefit them very much. And let's not forget the cost of fuel, insurance, parking, maintenance, and so on.
Yeah, but as long as in my street you're allowed to park if you as a resident, when you have what's it called? You have to pay 40 euros a year.
Yeah, permit.
To get a permit to park there, which is.
Well, that's very cheap, actually. And many people, if you live in New York, you're paying $400 a month for a parking garage. If you live in London,
for a garage you pay the same. But if you find a place on the street.
Which is not guaranteed, but I understand. In London, parking places are starting to reach 1 million. And this is a private parking. It's ridiculous, the parking situation. But yes, point taken. I think when I talk about utility value, I'm only measuring distance. Within the cost of ownership of a car, you have, this is why I try to quantify miles in terms of dollars by relating them. There's one trick I use, which is that when you own a car and you're using it for business, you're allowed to deduct its utilization against your taxes. I'm sure it's the same in Germany.
Yeah.
So the number in the United States is about 52, 53 cents per mile. So if you are therefore going to capture your car's value, you can define it with that number. There are other agencies like the American Automobile Association, which tell you how much your car is going to cost you on a per mile basis. So if you have a cheap car like a Toyota Prius, which is very economical, then it's going to cost you 30 cents a mile. And if you have a very luxury car or pickup truck or something like that, it's going to cost you close to a dollar a mile. But it turns out that the average is about 50 cents. So both the if you cost the car's depreciation, fuel, maintenance, parking, tolls, everything according to that. And then you take all that money you spent over its lifetime, divide by the number of miles you travel, it comes out to about 50 cents a mile. And so I suppose in Germany, it's probably 50 cents a kilometer, given the fact that, you know, fuel is more expensive and taxes and so on. Maybe not quite, but it could be something like 30 to 40 cents a kilometer. And in the alternatives which are coming, and by the way, this may include car sharing, but these alternatives that are coming, they're going to charge you a lot less, and you also don't need to put up that money up front, and so on. So this is a revolution, and I think the cost is actually much lower on a per use basis.
So I've already taken up a lot of your time. Because many of the people, including me, they just can't wait for the cities to empty of the cars, to get rid of the cars.
And that's why I'm asking also. I mean, I think the vehicles are maybe going to take 10 years of services and so on, but the cities may actually be slow to adapt.
I mean, in Germany, we are in Cologne. Cologne has a Ford factory. They built the Fiesta, and they are frightened about what is going to happen in, I think, 6 years when the current contract ends. Mm-hmm. So
maybe Fiesta is not a bad car because it's a small one, but I would think that maybe they will abandon the small and move to bigger cars. I don't know. It's difficult to predict.
But it's hard to do any legislation against car companies in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not
we don't even have speed limits on.
I like driving in Germany, but the problem is that it's only interesting in long distances.
Yeah.
I think the car will be pushed out of the city center because of various regulation, including car-free zones, including pollution controls, including congestion charges. And although Germany may be slower than let's say, you know, Denmark or maybe even Sweden or Finland, because it has a strong lobby, because it has a lot of economic value in the industry, it will still happen. It's one of these things that you have to have faith in long term.
Last year, I worked on autonomous vehicles, and I talked to people from the public transport. And mm-hmm. public transport in, at least in Germany, is even slower and completely unaware of their of even the other, each public transport company works for themselves, apparently. Mm-hmm. And they don't even manage to work together. And do you think there will be possibilities to, bring this personal transport together with the public transport?
It's a very tough question, because I like public transport, but it's limited by one important constraint, and it doesn't address every possible start and end point. This is why it's vulnerable. It's the difference, and the reason the car became such a hit, again, long after there was public transport. If you go to the 19th century, there were first horse-drawn cars rail cars, and then eventually we ended up with metros, and we ended up with electric trams. All of those were available before the car. The car came and completely absorbed all these new trips and created its own demand, and then created and stole a lot of the demand from public transit. Why? Because it was so much more convenient. Why? Because it was going any point to any point, And, you know, the tragedy in the U.S. was that it seemed like the car destroyed a more efficient means of transport. But at the time, it made a lot of sense to those who did it. It made a lot of economic sense. It made a lot of service and quality of service sense. And now we're looking back with sorrow to that. But what this new mode is even more personal. This mode is so personal that you don't even need to own the vehicle, but you can go anywhere to anywhere. And so that's why I don't have a lot of hope for transit, because it's constrained also by capacity. Once you are defining the start and endpoints, and you're defining the mode of transport in terms of the vehicle, it's always going to be slow to change, and it's going to go to capacity and not grow beyond capacity, because expanding capacity is very difficult. And China, for example, I mean, China built its infrastructure for public transit very quickly. It went from having, I think, one metro system in the whole country to having something like 100 metro systems with thousands and thousands of stations. And it did that in 20 years. And now those systems are at capacity. In other words, they got full right away. And as a result, people have to queue outside the station to get into it and get to the train. Now, if you gave those people an option of private transport, they'll take it. And so it's I don't see it as a solution to the problem. It's going to stay and be useful, but it's not going to absorb the next few billion people that are going to move into cities.
The public transport, you mean?
Yeah. The public transport is not scalable.
Yeah,
unless you're building stations and unless you're putting new trains in or new lines of trains. And as you know, this is a very slow, laborious process to expand an existing network. Mm. And as soon as it's expanded, it fills up completely. So you're back to having no capacity. So at peak anyway. So the utilization is a problem. You should talk to a company called MAS Global, MAAS. They are a Finnish company here in Finland who sells subscriptions to bundles of transit and other forms of like taxi and sharing and bike sharing. And
from Helsinki.
Yeah. Yeah. And what they're writing on top of is the fact that, well, bundling is important. So people would like to have one ticket for all the systems, and as you said, they don't interoperate, but they can aggregate them at a higher level. So you have an app and you show it to the system. Okay, it won't work everywhere, but generally that's what they're trying to implement. So aggregation will come, and secondly, they integrate also these personal systems. And so they allow the user to have more convenience. And to me, that makes a lot of sense, because the user will say, okay, I want one app to go anywhere to anywhere. And if I use transit, I use transit. And by the way, the reason they make some money is because a lot of these transit systems have excess capacity. So they're going to sell to them. They say, fine, bring more people. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, it's self-regulated. But taxis are like that. Taxis don't get enough utilization. So they'll give a cheaper rate to an aggregator. Anyway, it's a long story, but I see it as being a part of the whole picture, but not the one that will absorb the most growth.
Yeah, what they told me as well was that they don't want private companies, and they spoke of Uber, for example, to have all the data about the traffic. They want to have it mm-hmm. themselves.
Well, you get the data that you can get.
So is there, you know, is there a will, and there's I think you he was at the in Copenhagen as well. This co-founder of Donkey Republic, and they say that there must be legislation for those new mobility
Well, yes, of course.
So, for example, if you use a infrastructure, you have to give the city data in exchange.
Yeah,
for example,
there will be all kinds of legislation. I assure you. The problem is there are thousands of cities and there are thousands of communities, and each one wants to define some rules, but there's no consensus on a global scale on what is the right rules. We know that at fundamental level, never mind this very, very technical level. So I don't expect that to be, the leading question. The leading things are always about behavior and human behavior. Mm-hmm. And eventually, from that behavior will come the economics, then will come the legislation, then will come, you know, the questions of society. So it's being careful about what goes first in the causal chain. So if you say, I wish people would behave better, then you don't get there by saying, please behave better. You get there by creating systems that create incentives, that create economics, that create also boundaries, and then behavior changes. And so we are all focused on behavior, but in order to make that change, and I think even at the level of a planetary kind of sustainability, we all look at the final data, but to get that change in behavior, we have to start much further away, and that's the system we have is you know, fundamentally economic, and what's interesting is how historically this has happened, and it's not been top down, it's been bottom up. And that's my hope, is that this technology we have is a very low level, very accessible technology, and it has potential to make people happy. So if they're happy, then they'll change behavior. It's not the stick, it's the carrot.
All right. So there's no need to be afraid of an Uberization of transport.
There'll be imbalances.
Or would that be a bad thing?
What I think about is that there are these systems, when they change, they will create imbalances, and there will be data that will fall in the hands of companies that may misuse it and may allow it to be badly used by others. Okay, this is the phenomenon of we've seen of social media as well. And so there will be the phrase that's used is data exhaust. In other words, just like a car has an emission, an unintended result, mm-hmm, of the combustion process. The data many times of people writing these systems and these systems being digital is that there'll be data generated. And that data, if someone will begin to collect it, and maybe it's useful, maybe it's not, but maybe there'll be a market for it if it is useful. But I think we'll have to find out how to regulate that much after the system is in place. If we try to do it in advance, well, we just don't know how people will use it. We don't know any of that. In fact, the companies who are building these systems, I point out to them that, look, the data might be the most valuable thing you create, but they're right now just trying to get the vehicles working. So they're not concerned yet with the data. But at some point, just like, you know, Apple was not concerned with the consequences of Facebook when it built the iPhone, which then required them to build an app store, which required them to allow developers to build apps, and which then, you know, Facebook took advantage of. And as a result, we ended up with what we have. Now, again, Steve Jobs didn't anticipate that, and no one did. And now we have to deal with the consequences. But if it were in 2007 and you started to say, hey, hang on, let's not do apps because they might get misused, or let's regulate the data that's on the network, a lot of that would have constrained the whole system to such an extent that no one would build anything. And so it's kind of, again, it's one of the consequences of building great things is that there's a lot of also bad things, but we can't act on the bad before we have the great. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And then one last question: Will we still walk in the future?
It's funny because a lot of people think that scooters substitute walking, and I'm sure they do to some degree. But the thing about both the car and the scooter, and maybe the bike, is that it created its own demand. Most of the trips that are taken now are because we suddenly can go places we couldn't go before. If you had a society like medieval society where people could only walk, you had very small cities. You had cities that you could be traversing in only 1 hour. And that's what, if you look at the size of medieval cities, they were all very small. And now we have very big cities. And the more the car is in use, the bigger the city is. So if you go to a town in in Texas, it's enormous. And you can't get anywhere without a car. But what's interesting about scooters is that if we end up abandoning cars for scooters, we might end up also shrinking the city again. Because what would happen is, well, people will say, look, I want to get rid of my car, but that means I can't live in the suburbs. And so I'm going to, we're going to see more gentrification. We're going to see young people saying, well, I can't live more than 10 kilometers from all my friends. And so people want to live in cities more. And, the data on Germany is also like young people are avoiding getting cars, avoiding getting driver's license. And so we might have a re-urbanization or re-central. Now, I think that doesn't mean people won't walk. Walking is still rather efficient for very short distances. And I think I don't see that disappearing completely. I think the scooter generally is going to compete more with the bigger vehicle, and it's going to compete more with again non-consumption, as we say. Non-consumption means trips that you wouldn't have taken if it wasn't for that type of vehicle. So that's why I explained to people like this. I said, look, the car created several things about social behavior. One is that you go cruising, and this is an American phenomenon. So a form of socialization where you drive in your car up and down the street for no good reason, except to be seen by others and to see other people. So it's a way of mingling, a way of going on the promenade, on the boulevard. This was the equivalent before the car. And so Americans would go on the boulevard by driving up and down the street. They also went to the mall. To the teenagers would go to the mall and walk up and down the mall for the same reason. This was their boulevard. But the thing is, because of the car, you either go up and down a street or you go to a mall and you walk up and down the mall, but you have to go there with a car. Now, the thing about scooters is that we might see new forms of behavior as well for socialization. So if you want to socialize and you are a young person, you want to go on a date, you want to impress a girl, then you hop on a scooter and you go places where scooters go. And these may not be places where cars are possible. So I would look for this kind of behavioral change. And then you know something's happening on the social level, right? You're going to have parties and events where only scooters go, and that will be very interesting, right? Because these parties, these impromptu events might be, and again, I use scooter as a general term. It could be cycling as well, but going to an abandoned place for a dance party or something like that. That's and there's no parking and it's inaccessible. It's perhaps it's not possible to get there without the scooter. That's to me the interesting change in behavior we might see, because the car made behavior and trips happen, and our living spaces and our workspaces were formed by it. So we know we have successes when people make new things because they're enabled by a new vehicle. And by the way, the bicycle did the same thing. There's a famous story about how cycling reduced the rate of incest.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard me say this, but I heard it for both France and UK that because the villages now, people could travel between villages. So it formed the ability to date people as we know it. So new forms of romance, new forms of, once you're dealing with romance, you know you're winning, right? Because that's so important, right? That is so important in people's lives. And so I would look for these kind of things. And I think the way also language will change is that people will use different words to describe this. So they'll use a verb to describe, like I said, cruising is a verb that means that you go up and down the street with a car. And so one would imagine that there'll be something like it emerging as well for, and now we think about texting and we think about Facebooking and all these other things that we do with our social media, mm-hmm. or tweeting. There's a word that we created, tweeting. Or swiping, you know, that when you're using a dating app, you swipe left, swipe right. These are words that people know what they mean, but they're created because of the technology. So now we have to see what the words that will be created for scooting. And so scooting will come to mean something, will come to mean not just going someplace, but perhaps socializing there. So if that happens again, you know you're winning. So look for language change, behavior change, social change. And once those are usually by young people as early adopters, then you're on the way. You're on the way there. It's going to be an avalanche after that.